Many yeshivot put a special emphasis these days on positive, encouraging relationships between the Rebbes and the students. We live in a culture that reverence for the Torah scholar and the Rebbe is on the decline. What does the Rebbe see as the boundaries between relationships between Rebbeim and students? Could the Rebbe give guidelines as to when being too close to students is inappropriate? How can a Rebbe maintain an appropriate distance from his students and demand respect while still showing love and care for them?
It's a good question in the tall order. I'm not certain that I buy what seems to be somewhat implicit in the opening remark, namely that, or maybe explicit later remarks, namely that the closeness between Tarbeim and Tamidim engenders a decline of reverence, or is itself the product of a decline of reverence. I would like to think that closeness of a certain kind, at least, should be not only feasible but highly desirable, without eating into the reference you have in mind, and that educationally, we can be in a position of I understand where people who think in terms of distance are coming from, and there are mekayves for it. Mekayves in classical sources, Chazal, Rambam, and mekayves also in real life encounters, whether with Rabbeim or with other personages. Part of the reverence is, part of some of the issues are the issues that we have to do not necessarily with our own occurs, but with the sense of distance that needs to be, that one might think needs to be sustained if to avoid too great a measure of familiarity and if we want to establish a measure of reverence. But there is, I think, a lot of flexibility for this in halacha. But I've written a number of places, doesn't say whether Rav should be merchel or should not be merchel. And I think this will be left open, as with regard to parents as well. So I want to be a Bismarckian parent or a Chumby parent, precisely because the variables here are very, very significant. What will be the byproducts of a close or distant relationship depends to a great extent on what the preconceptions are. My mother, Rosh Hashanah, went to school in Eastern Europe. And she told me my mother was not stupid with Rosh Hashanah. But when she was 8 or 10, she was convinced that the teachers didn't eat. She never saw them eating. If you went to Chaim Berlin for 4 years, as I did, you might also have thought the Hashiva didn't eat. Because he never ate, unless on chasen and stuff like that, but on a daily, on a regular basis, never ate with the Bachim, went to Camp Morris, he was there, and never ate with the Oilim. And he was very keen in maintaining a sense of distance. And yet, paradoxes may sound, I was sure that I know that I've encountered, he was by far the one who had the most profound influence in terms of direct intimacy and almost the point of control with Tamidim. And the Rabbi, the Rav Zichron Livracha, the Rabbi Livracha, in this respect, at the polar opposite. I remember when I used to be raised in a house when I was a young boy of 16, and he used to carry out the garbage. the incinerator. Some of the older Bachir with Chai Berlin were very critical. We ever heard of Goshir carrying out garbage? I was shocked that they were shocked, because they recognized that if he didn't carry out the garbage, there were no maids around, his wife would have to carry out the garbage. And then you have a decision to make. Where does Kavarotel stand with the recovery of your wife? I can't tell you that there have been a solution for this. I know other sources. First by William the Fourth, Shakespeare's Prince Hal is still so as Wild Oats. And he gets the speech of his father, Henry the Fourth, telling him all about this nonsense, fooling around with Falstaff, etc., etc. And telling him, if you want to maintain respect, you have to be visible on a very limited basis. You have to spoon feed the public with your presence. Precisely in order that it should be an event. The Chazal, the Dharma Kodesh, that the Melacha should be done for a Tamidim, etc. And then the Medrash says, he says, in effect, I never asked any of them to carry anything for me. And we all know the Arash Yeshiva who needs to be Shamashim to carry one suitcase. I think it's very important. The personal relationship is very important. And I don't think it undermines the reverence. Unless you have been pre-programmed, with preconceptions, the carrying of garbage out of your home and house, the wife should have to carry it out. It's a priest's kabbalatera, if that's what you feel. So of course you will think this is less and less of kabbalatera. But even in terms of, well, I mean, other areas where I could see, where I could very well see someone objecting that if Rabbeim play ball with Talmidim, as some Shiva high school certainly they do, that's a priest of kabbalatera. Now the priest kabbalatera is perceived, though thereby Talmud is a dual one. First of all, the Rabbeim shouldn't be playing basketball together. It's not proper, it's not kabbalatera, they shouldn't be swimming. But even for us playing basketball, at least with other Rabbeim, not with Talmidim. But with Talmidim, not his own Talmidim, somebody else's Talmidim. I understand all of this, but I'm not cut out for it. And I think there's an enormous danger involved in this as well. Where does Kavod HaTorah end and Kavod Atzmi begin? The dangers of puffery, of putting on airs, where you have, I won't mention any names, but you have people with Tamidim of some of the people that I mentioned, and what was befitting the Rosh Yeshiva, it has to be fitting as Talmidim. It's what's described in Macbeth, some was stolen of a thief who stole the clothing of someone whose size is very different from his own. It doesn't hang well. And the dangers of self-aggrandizement and being puffed up are enormous dangers, spiritual dangers. I think if one is going to err, and I can see maintaining some degree of distance, sometimes even for matters of convenience, but I would clearly, if I were going to err, I much prefer to err on the side of having too much anivus than having too much gaiva. And the dangers of gaiva are very clear in this respect. I'm sure that people maintain the distance from Shemayim, but I think it's a fine line that needs to be borne in mind as well.
What works of literature should be part of a modern Orthodox day school curriculum? Which one should not?
It's pretty easy to start with those that should not.
Hmm.
It's so difficult to deal with this issue in limbo or in a vacuum. So much depends on what's good to read, not good to read, on the total personality, the total cultural exposure, and the total exposure of a student, of a student body, and what kind of spiritual literary diet you're going to present to them cannot be dealt with without some consideration of who are you feeding. Generally speaking, I'm drawn naturally to works which are within the great books axis, inspirational, which deal with fundamental issues of human nature, of human destiny, of one's relation to the world, eventually to oneself. And that doesn't mean they're all long hair kind of works, or they're all very heavy kind of works. But the topics, the areas on which they touch, I think those are the most important. The areas, if these are those that should not, there's so much a waste of time. And time is a critical effort factor in our lives generally, and in modern Orthodox context particularly. If modern Orthodox institution takes it up seriously, students there should be working twice as hard as those who are in a non-modern Orthodox school. Those are in a second school altogether, because they're having a double load. And the budget, time-wise, is very limited. Now, that many of these schools, all kinds of frills, hockey teams, dramatic societies, and all kinds of other things are part of the regular fare. I don't know where people can find the time for all that. So number one, you have to weigh very carefully what kind of works are worth the investment of time and effort. Those which are not significant, don't contribute significantly, I think are not part of the curriculum. Then there's some which are problematic in terms of content. And here we come across an issue with which I find myself grappling over the years. I find difficulty in arriving at a clear resolution. In the nature of things, the works which deal with the kind of issues that I mentioned before are works which come out of a religious tradition. And there are secular people who deal with these issues as well. But the ones which are long out of track are those which come out of a religious tradition. And that means to a great extent that you find yourself confronted as a mechanech between two choices. One being secular material, you don't run into issues of Christianity and the Rizora, etc., etc. But it's secular. Or dealing with works which have profound religious content, but which involve an exposure to elements of a Rizora. When I say an exposure, I don't think that anyone is likely to convert to Christianity, to Islam, if he reads the Quran, if he reads by the New Testament, or certainly not if he reads works which are not quite the canonized works of other religious traditions, but which are rooted in that world. I remember many years ago, I was still a Stern Collegist in the back of the 50s, a student approached me, she had a problem, she's taking a course in history, I think it was, maybe intellectual history, and they're supposed to read a passage or two in the New Testament. I said, let me look at the anthology. So the anthology has it's a historical sequential, and apart from and part of the anthology, a couple of notches historical ladder, segments of Lucretius the Rerum Natura. And I asked her, I said, Lucretius, she wasn't worried about him. He said, someone who's a total epicurus, denies everything. Everything we hold near and dear to us. So that, you had no problem with, but New Testament you had a problem with. And I understand this is really not a Kal v'chomer, because one might argue that if you deal with an alternate religion, which might have a certain, attracts a certain appeal, and then you deal with something which you ought to speak more neutral. But if we're going to deal with serious literary works, which tell us something, give something of an insight into one's confrontation and grappling with the relation to Malchus Shemayim, broadly conceived, we have to make some difficult choices in this respect. If we're going to cut Milton out, so someone will say, well, they're not going to cut Milton out, but we'll cut certain things and part of Milton out, and then I can buy it. Someone will say, well, Sam Stagnistis will read, Paris Lost will read, maybe we'll skip a passage here or there, but Paris Began we won't read. I can see that. But cutting out works which deal with the grappling of the human soul. I mean, let's take Augustine's Confessions. First seven chapters are enormously stimulating, enormously powerful in every respect. Once he gets to the eighth, he gets to Christological interpretations of the early Procumen Bereshis, that I said I would not recommend reading. I come out of, in terms of my literary preferences, I come out of Arnold's school, high seriousness of noble purpose. That's the first test of what you want to include in your diet. When I say high seriousness, I don't mean necessarily the only tragedy and not comedy. From a certain point of view, Aristophanes and Rabelais and Swift, those are very high seriousness of a different kind. That has to be the test, where it's consonant, with emunah in a profound sense. That has to be a test. And I think you have to approach this on the one hand with a lot of guidelines, and then ask yourself, maybe some people derive the conclusion of a lot of guidelines, then we have to check all of this and forget it. But if you find that you can work with the halakhic guidelines, trying to judge what you understand by the simulasis, what lemelasis means, if you find it more broadly, those should be the criteria. The issues here, to some cases, are not simple. I wrote a piece in the volume which titled Judaism in General Culture, Rejection of Integration, which was edited by Rabbi Dr. Schachter, and which had some of these issues. The Rambam, of course, by Mizrach Rabbi Schachter, is very, very strict, and yet he tells very clearly he read all the material. Now, some people say, okay, the Rambam could read it, but you can't read it. I can understand that. But that brings us back to what I said earlier, you have to know who your audience is, with whom you're dealing. So there are no Rambams out there, but even with ordinary people, also the question is, who are you dealing with is there? I know I have not given you a clear answer, which is that tomorrow morning what to read. But I don't think there is a clear answer. You have to grapple with this issue, trying to balance various elements, and trying to gauge what the impact will be if it's Hashem who brings Gemalach or not.
Could you please address co-education in the 21st century modern Orthodox high school setting? It would be nice to know about priorities and leeway for financial and other issues.
Could you just repeat the last sentence?
The person asked, it would be also nice to know in terms of if there are financial issues in terms of separating classes and not in smaller schools, you know, how that plays in.
Obviously, in general, I'm not in favor of co-education in high schools. I've been asked to address some of this issue here and there in the past, and people waive precedence with the law, et cetera, et cetera. If the Rav found it proper to do what he did, I certainly do not regard myself in a position of having desire to challenge the halakhic grounds. I make a damn fool out of myself, and that I don't want to do. But if you ask me, where do I think the kind of atmosphere, the kind of climate, of the intensity in terms of personal growth and learning in Yiras Shamayim and Midas, would I find more of that than a co-educational school or a non-co-educational school? I think the test anyone can make it for himself. You ask another question, and let me say this, it's not a question just to be surim. It's a question of optimally where education, you run a wide gamut from relatively minimal situations to maximal situations. Sense of growth, sense of wanting to maintain the vision of greatness. The level of aspiration. That is critical to what we're trying to inculcate in Talmidim, even if we're speaking only in general secular standards. But we're not speaking secular standards, we're speaking Torah standards. And Torah standards, the aspiration for Yiras Shamayim, for Lamdus, that's what a 14, 15-year-old has to have in his mind. He's got more of that in his mind than a non-co-educational survivor, than another co-educational. Now you come and say, well, but supposing there was a situation where there are financial budgetary considerations, that cannot be ignored. In some communities, the option is either a co-ed school or a strikeout for either boys or girls. Usually that means a strikeout for girls. I am a commitment to women's education for many, many reasons and many, many levels. I would be deeply pained if I had to determine in a particular community that there's no option for Torah education for women. My information is in the past, not only the Rav minimally held that in such a situation, you want to have a co-educational school. That's in a way, in a sense, the way in which the school developed in Boston. Once developed, then there was a lot of inertia too, but Chatkhira was, I believe, as far as I know, that was the kind of thinking that was behind it. I've been told, I mentioned Rabbi Hutzkhira previously, at least one community in which he was asked point blank, we either have a mixed school or one of the sexes is out. And he said, to have a mixed school. I didn't hear it directly from him, but someone told me. I do feel, however, that if that's done in a particular community, there should be an element of the effort about it to begin with. And part of the situation with the Eved is striving eventually to move from the Eved to the Chetchil. If you open such a school, because of the financial budget exigencies, can't have class with three students in them. That should be with a sense which animated at least the Balabatim and Chanchim. We're doing this now because it's important and we don't want to leave one of the genders outside. But our hope is in due time we won't have a larger school with budgetary possibilities which enable having both genders represented. So I say again, I don't relate to this as a halachic issue in the narrow sense of the term. I want to see what will produce the most serious climate for growth in an Avedis Hashem. I say this not Chas V'Sholom by way of demeaning or denigrating or diminishing the significance of all the work that's being done in co-ed schools. And a lot of good work is being done within them. A lot of good students are coming out of them. And I appreciate and admire all that's being done by the Mechanchim, the administration, in those schools. If you ask me from the point of view of the Talmidim collectively, which way would be better off, I would prefer to see schools separate. And I certainly would challenge the kind of educational philosophy that you have in some segments of Israeli society, maybe here too, regarding mixed schools, not as a b'dieved at all, but as chatchila shel chatchila. Kind of thinking that the kibbutz adati has been pushing for a long time. That I would certainly reject.
Rav Lichtenstein sees many graduates, boys and girls, of the yeshiva high school system coming to Eretz Yisrael. What, in the Rebbe's opinion, is the single biggest area of challenge in learning that the typical American high school student faces? What are the biggest area of challenge in his or her overall religious development, and how has that changed over the past 30 years?
What would be the greatest challenge for the student, for the yeshivas, what are we talking about?
That the students are coming out, the graduates of the yeshiva high schools, in terms of what areas and deficiencies in terms of learning and in terms of overall in terms of religious development, what are the...
Well, generally speaking, I should say, there is a sense that people you're talking about have greater proficiency as compared to Israeli peers, let's say. Greater proficiency in analytic skills, that kind of intellectual activity, and less textual mastery. That's probably true and understandably so. But I think the greatest challenge is not necessarily the learning end. The learning end, there are certainly challenges. Part has to do with linguistic and textual skills. A great deal has to do with the range of knowledge. The range of knowledge is very limited. And there's people, this is now an initiative of some, whether it's widespread over here with all kinds of cards and games, Tayag Mitzvot, which is an interesting issue. But the major knowledge with which Bochum comes is limited. Much of that is true also when they come out of Israeli high schools. Also, the range of knowledge is limited. But if I had to consider where to send a boy or a girl to learn in Eretz Yisrael, I would place the learning in proper perspective, which means that fundamentally the most important element is the educational one, less the intellectual one, less the cognitive one. Yirat Shamayim, depth of commitment, intensity of commitment, depth of emunah, intensity of emunah. For many American students, this is particularly a challenge because many of them come to chatchila determined to put in their time a year or two and move on to other settings. And after that, there's been a lot of debate, as you probably know. It's published pro and con. I consider the challenge spiritually, educationally, Das Veshkofe, more critical and more important, maybe not more difficult, seemingly, but more critical and more important than the question of how much Gemara they know and how well they can analyze the text. But that's not to say that these are not important areas. These are very important areas, and the activity which they engage is, of course, that which they do part most of the day. But what's most deeply associated with their personality and their growth is to what extent they come in and are able to internalize what it means to be an Eved Hashem, what it means to be an Eved Hashem. I come out of Elohim in certain respects. And that means, of course, the Torah Lishma, using it as simply as a Archimedes fulcrum in order to inculcate spiritual values. But I think the Chaim Elohim himself saw the level which we were dealing, he would have gone along with this evaluation as well. Part of the problem is in general for us, particularly where we need to not simply supply the spiritual fear that people want. We've got to develop the appetite even as we're trying to give them the proper meal. Now, this is not a only problem for our kind of Eilam, but it's more of a problem. Remember, some years back, I attended a bar mitzvah where the grandson of Chaim Berlin, my Chaim Berlin, and another fellow was in attendance there who had been a very close friend of ours. We were all in Chaim Berlin. He's now one of the prominent rabbeim in Slabodka. He's about my age, but this was 5-6 years ago. And he said, my greatest challenge in Slabodka is to get my Talmidim to feel that Torah should be the most important thing in their lives. I opened my eyes and said to Mordechai, Etu? Slabodka? But Haskam Bacham are the problems that we have. But that's the most important thing. I hope that the learning is valuable per se and contributes to the spiritual growth as well. And I believe that happens in many, many cases. I wish it happened in more, but it happens in quite many cases.
Rav Lichtenstein, we thank you so much for spending some time with us. It's greatly appreciated. I know your schedule is packed when you come to America. Thank you so much for coming this evening.
Just have a concluding remark. I came because Rabbi Bender asked me to come, and if I can contribute to him from a distance something to Chinuch in America, I'm more than happy to do so. On the other hand, I don't want to feel such people write about Kolbich that in his elder years he stopped writing and was defined as the sage of Highgate. People come to Meir Regel to visit him where he lived in Highgate section of London and to hear him pontificate. The issues of Chinuch that we're talking about, the ones with which we deal, about which we think, about which we dream, are far too important to be left to pontification. I don't want anyone to think that here Allah Ribi Bovel or Allah Ribi Hans Yisrael, and he's got all the answers. What I have to do is ask me to come down and spend an hour or two, and you go home and you know exactly what to do. I don't pretend that I know everything what to do. I don't pretend that my yeshiva is perfect. I certainly don't imagine that I'm perfect. But I think that we live our lives as b'chanchim. Partly, the mechanich in us has to be the chanich in us. to understand it's an evolving process. The things you perceive at the age of 40, when you know when we're 30, the things at 70, you don't know when it's 40. We need to approach these issues looking at ourselves in the mirror with honesty, with sensitivity, with concern, with the realization that Lo lecha mlocha ligmor. In a sense, that means also Lo lecha mlocha lakif. We cannot do, we do not do all that we would like as mechanchim. The Rav Chilavach once said about parenting, if someone tells you to achieve with his children everything that you want, is a liar. And I say to others, I say to myself, everyone tells me, says, Chinuch, you accomplished everything that you wanted, either he's a liar or he began with standards which are far too low. We don't want low standards in Chinuch. And I know that having high standards is something frustrating and it eats you up. And here are the people who have told me the trouble with you is your standards are too high. And I grapple, I wrestle with myself. Rabbi Yaakov Kavetsky is reputed to have said, "Is applies to chinuch as well." And I appreciate, he was a wonderful person, I appreciate that remark, and it's, you find some comfort in it. But at the same time, we don't want to be Sumer Bechelke in chinuch. At the same time, we don't have a right to be Sumer Bechelke. Be Sumer Bechelke in chinuch means that I'm satisfied with what I've accomplished. But I'm not the business of chinuch to accomplish for myself. I'm the business of to accomplish for Talmidim. And who authorized me to give minimal status for Talmidim? So we need to grapple with one end, the yearning to grow and to aspire and to develop ourselves and our Talmidim. The other end, to have the ability to appreciate minimal accomplishments as well. The last of the world we want is to have high standards and leave anybody who doesn't meet them, spiritually and psychologically, the dumps. This is what makes chinuch so challenging and so testing. As part of what makes the honesty of an approach to chinuch so critically important. So don't go home thinking that you've heard some kind of pontificate and answer a few questions to tell you exactly what to do. You've heard someone try to share with you out of his own experience and out of a sense of honesty and approach to the issues. Some of us could say some of the concerns that we have as b'chanachim. I wouldn't want to have gone home without providing at least retrospective light upon what the things I said here. And we all have Siyata Dishmaya, Melech HaKodesh, in which we are engaged. May we grow in our love for the melacha that we're doing and the success that we have. Shavua Tov.